And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, in our third week of isolation, I guess you could call it, I placed an order, a pickup order with Target. And when I went to get it, because I had pulmonary disease already, my wife didn't want me to get out of the truck. She got out, and a young lady from the store brought the order out to the truck. Well, a few spaces away, a gentleman parked a blue pickup truck. I glanced at him, but I didn't pay any attention. I was sitting down in my seat and not moving, and with my tinted windows, it was a little hard to see. And he walked behind my truck, and for some reason I sat up and looked back to check on my wife and a young lady loading the truck. Well, when he saw me, the guy from the blue pickup truck ran back and got inside. I think what I did was interrupt a snatch and run. Now, there's already been folks break into some of the empty houses where folks have left to go to their ranches or what have you. And I think what I was seeing was a plan by this gentleman to abscond with what I had purchased. I called the store and talked to the manager, made him aware. They hadn't really considered anything like that. But you've got usually young ladies bringing the stuff out to the trucks that have been ordered for pickup. I mean, they're just targets of opportunity for these folks. Now, had he done anything, as is my normal policy when away from the house, I was armed. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened. But when you're dealing with a snatch and grab and run, they depend on speed. And both of the women at the back of my truck together didn't weigh as much as this guy did. So I'm sure he planned on knocking them down, grabbing the stuff, and, as we used to say in the military, beat feet. Didn't quite work out that way, and now Target's going to have somebody watching the pickup to make sure that doesn't happen. But as time goes on and people are locked down longer, you're going to see things like this. Folks that did not prepare are going to get awful damn hungry, and they're going to do whatever they can to get something to eat. The the news is interesting. We've got a lot of the liberal left having a royal meltdown over the fact that the undocumented aliens aren't going to get stimulus checks. Well, let's be frank. Nobody asked them to come. And Newsom and Cuomo are both letting convicted murderers out of jail. In fact, Newsom just commuted the sentence of 14 convicted killers. That's one of his responses to the coronavirus. He's provided release for about 19 felons, some of whom killed children and one convict who murdered a pregnant woman. And two of the felons are immigrants to the U.S., and he's commuting their sentence, going to help them get out of town so they don't get deported. In fact, the 19 felons given commutations by Newsom includes a 50-year-old man convicted of stabbing his pregnant wife to death, 75-year-old woman convicted of assaulting a child and killing it, 35-year-old Christopher Blem convicted of aiding in a murder, 64-year-old Joanne Parks convicted of killing her three children. 67-year-old Rosemary Dyer convicted of murdering her husband. 40-year-old Jason Bryant convicted of witnessing murder during a robbery. In other words, he killed a witness during the robbery. 56-year-old Stephen Bradley convicted of murdering a gas station worker. 64-year-old Richard Flowers murdered a woman. 61-year-old Samuel Eldridge convicted of shooting a person to death. 49-year-old Ramon Rodriguez convicted of murdering a person for pay, in other words, a hitman. 56-year-old James Harris convicted of kidnapping and murdering two people. 48-year-old Robert Glass convicted of murdering a burglary victim. 45-year-old David Jassy convicted of murdering a man he was fighting with. 68-year-old Cheryl Lamar convicted of witnessing the murder of two people. Tri Tai, an immigrant, convicted of assault, dissuading a witness, and burglary. Mansaru Tihani, an immigrant, convicted of issuing fake financial statements. Shannon Thomas Bland, convicted of drugs. Gabriel Garcia, convicted of drugs. And Brenda Ibanez, convicted of robbery and using a fake ID to buy a vehicle. And he also pardoned five others who previously served their sentences for various crimes. I mean, he's just gone nuts. To him, the whole world is innocent, no matter what you've been convicted of. Rob Reiner is on one of his usual rants. Trump's got a mental illness. It's killing people. Yada, 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 yada. Ben Carson calls for homeless tent cities. Susan Rice is upset that nobody recognizes her brilliance. She says Trump has a particular problem with strong black women. And he's race baiting by using the Wuhan virus term. And Alec Baldwin, in one of his brilliant statements, the virus in the U.S. began in January 2017. That's when Trump took office. Well, let's see what else we got. Maxine Waters, not to be left out, is ranting and raving Trump's an incompetent idiot and he has to pray to God for forgiveness. I don't know what he has to be forgiven for. Maybe not having her prosecuted for not living in her own district. She represents one of the poorer districts in California, but she lives in a mansion. Of course, nobody dares question Ms. Maxine, as she's called. All right, now, it's interesting that as this shutdown goes forward, a lot of people are ignoring it completely. There's a class action suit against Beijing over this disease, the fact they didn't tell anybody about it for quite some time. A dozen sick and two dead after an ill-advised Washington choir practice. Folks just don't listen. Right now, worldwide, there's 803,650 confirmed cases, 39,000 deaths. In the U.S., 164,785 confirmed cases, 3,173 deaths. It's EPA says, don't flush coronavirus disinfectant wipes down the toilet. And AOC, not to be outdone, attack Cuomo on coronavirus response that she says gives preferential treatment to the wealthy. She says he's exacerbating racial and class divides by suspending mortgage payments during the pandemic but not extending the same moratorium to renters. I mean, she has just, if she had a hanky, she'd be stomping it all over the stage. A sociologist who walked nearly every New York City block just died from coronavirus. And let's see what else we got. Wearing gloves to the supermarket is not necessarily a good idea, according to Dr. Siegel. He prefers constant hand sanitization and washing over wearing gloves for safety purposes. He said gloves accumulate germs, accumulate viruses. He says you're not going to even realize when you touch something you have it on the gloves. Then you transfer it to your face and you get infected. He said you can't change them enough to make a difference, so I vote no on that one. Continual hand washing, though. But if you do wear gloves, make sure you take them off without touching the outside with your bare hands. And New York City is still the epicenter. As of this morning, 73,000 infected. Let's see. We just had our first military individual die. Pentagon takes aim at the coronavirus with 8,000 ventilators. They've modified four existing contracts with defense industry partners to acquire and deliver 8,000 ventilators. About 1,400 are expected to arrive by early May. First group slated to arrive within the next few days. And the MyPillow guy has put his factory to making masks. And CNN is having coronary arrest with him on camera with Trump. And the Don Lemon wants Trump's briefings taken off the air because he doesn't personally think the president ought to have all that time. USS Theodore Roosevelt commander says the entire crew needs to be isolated after 200 test positive. The USS Theodore Roosevelt is an aircraft carrier. Now ask yourself this. How did the coronavirus get on board the carrier? Now let's see what else we got. And there's swarms of locust, one of the plagues of Egypt, I might add, swarming in Africa, and coronavirus makes it harder to fight them. Let's see. No one is taking the lead internationally on Corona's response. China is stepping in to fill the void. So says the left, and so says China. The rest of the world says you don't know what you're talking about. And a lot of folk, you know, Nancy Pelosi is saying that Trump paid no attention to the first signs of this virus. And the first signs of this virus raised its head about the time she was passing out impeachment pens. So if anybody has blood on their hands, it's Pelosi and her little group of acolytes. All right. Having said all that, we were talking about some secrets of World War II. You know, by mid-1944, 35% of the men in the German army had been wounded at least once. 11% twice, 6% three times, 2% four times, 2% more than four times. And during the war, the average officer slot had to be refilled 9.2 times. They kept losing officers. And having been an officer, I can tell you that's not a good thing. Let's look at the Blitzkrieg, an operational tactic that enabled the German armies to gain unprecedented success in the field, especially true during the early years of the war. The word translates as lightning war, actually coined by a news correspondent, not by the Germans. brings to mind Hitler's panzers smashing their way across Europe. But the tank was only one cog in the machinery of this new form of warfare. And in fact, the tank was not the fundamental building block, but rather it was the internal combustion engine. It was a doctrine for the employment of motorized combined armed forces, tanks in cooperation with reconnaissance troops, infantry, artillery, engineers, logistical troops, and ground attack aircraft. The basic operational principle of Blitzkrieg was unity, with all elements not merely cooperating in action, but being integrated into combined arms combat teams at the very lowest level. We had something similar. Strategically, a Blitzkrieg operation had several phases. Off-march movement of to the enemy's front, something that could be done quite rapidly despite an apparent wide dispersal of forces, because all the attacking forces would be motorized. Gefechtsstreifen, concentration against a narrow sector of the enemy's front. Then Schwerpunkt, center of gravity of the attack, to be made with great force in contrast with numerous feints that would be undertaken simultaneously with the principal attack. That way you never knew which of the attacks was the main one. Einbruch, penetration of the enemy's front, which if successful would be followed by additional forces in order to achieve what was known as the Durchbruch, the breakthrough. Flanken-Luken-Taktik, tactics of space and gap, avoiding the enemy's reserves and strong points as much as possible, hitting him where he was the least able to defend himself. Off-rolling, or rolling up of the tattered ends of the pierced front, and the Kiel und Kessel, wedge and pocket. The encirclement of the enemy, and of course, that was all she wrote. The Blitzkrieg worked with a remarkable success in Poland, France, the Balkans, North Africa, and the Soviet Union, at least for the first few years of the war. But the success of the Blitzkrieg depended as much on the ineptitude of the enemy as upon the skill and capabilities of the German army. When he went up against a force that was as experienced, if not more so, than the attackers, it didn't work that way. Fender had to be surprised. He had to be intellectually and doctrinally inflexible, relatively immobile, inferior in anti-tank weaponry, lacking air superiority. And he had to fold up quickly as soon as his lines of communication had been destroyed. You know, when properly deployed for an attack in blunt wedge formation, a German panzer battalion of 75 to 90 tanks occupied an area of about 30 or 40 acres. That was a lot of armor coming in your direction. Now, tradition has it, Napoleon said an army marches on its stomach. What filled the stomach of Napoleon's armies most of the time was hardtack. Kind of similar to the Civil War forces. Hardtack and beans. Now, what you might refer to as gustatory arrangements have come a long way since that time. In the 20th century, most countries try to give their soldiers a more varied and nutritious diet. In addition to bakery units, by World War II, most armies included self-contained mobile butchering of animals, not people, let me assure you of that. That able to process enormous numbers of rations daily, and of course, they were the field rations that the troops were given. Now, the last ones I remember getting, the hot chocolate which was in it, it was instant hot chocolate, was literally undrinkable. And one of my soldiers poured it in a jungle you would find ant mounds, sometimes 3 and 4 feet tall. Poured it on an ant mound, and they all staggered out and died, which told you how effective the hot chocolate was. Now, post-war analysis of the causes of casualties brought up some interesting points. Now, casualties as a proportion of troops actually in contact with the enemy varied depending on the type and duration of an operation. They shouldn't be considered absolutely hard and fast. For example, Seasoned troops will suffer fewer casualties than green ones. And attacks conducted with inferior forces will incur greater casualties than those undertaken with overwhelming superiority. And fresh troops suffer fewer losses than tired ones. I mean, these are all basic things that never really were considered that important until they went back to looking after action reports. Now, the German army lost 136 generals in action during World War II. And that's an extraordinary number for any army in modern times. From September 39 to May of 45, the German army lost a general on the average of once every 2 weeks. 110 division commanders were killed in action or died of wounds, about one every 3 weeks. 23 corps commanders, roughly one every 14 weeks. And three army commanders, one every 95 weeks. And although the precise number, the precise causes of death is known in all instances, air attack appears to have been the principal cause. That accounted for about 32% of the deaths. Rommel himself was also numbered among those when his staff car was strafed in July of 44. Of course, Rommel was eventually killed by his own hand when Hitler decided he was a traitor and said, "You can kill yourself or I'll kill your family." All services counted together, there were about 3,000 generals and admirals in the German armed forces during the war. 84 were executed, 24 of them for treason by Hitler. The last one was actually Eva Braun's brother-in-law, Hermann Fegelin, who was shot April 28, 1945, for trying to desert the Führerbunker, and the rest by the Allies and the West Germans as a result of convictions of war crimes. And it was World War II that led to the decline of the utility of the horse in warfare. The introduction of the rifle and the machine gun made using horses on the battlefield very dangerous. World War I, with its endless lines of trenches, doomed the cavalry as an effective tactical arm forever, but the horse was still effective in a number of ways, most notably for transportation purposes. Horses actually saw more service during the Second World War than during the First. Despite the popular image of Polish lancers futilely charging German tanks, that never took place outside the imagination of the German propaganda ministry. The horse cavalry made something of a comeback during the war, though not in traditional roles. And it was such an unexpected development, it caught most armies by surprise. The German army, for example, began World War II with one cavalry division, and this performed very well during the Polish and French campaigns, but was converted to the 24th Panzer Division early in the Russian campaign. Soon afterward, the peculiar circumstances of the Russian front prompted the Germans to raise new mounted formations that were found particularly effective in anti-partisan operations and raids, notably in the frequent dense forests of western Russia. Actually, by the end of the war, the Germans had 7 horse cavalry divisions, mostly in the Waffen-SS, largely comprised of non-German personnel, mostly Ukrainians and Central Asians who preferred to fight against Stalin rather than for him. Italian horse cavalry units are also active with some success on the Russian front and even conducted what may have been the last successful charge in history. On the night of August 24th, 1942, two squadrons of the Savoia Light Cavalry Regiment launched a flank attack that overran a Russian infantry battalion near Itzbukinsky in the Ukraine. But it was the Russians who made the most extensive use of cavalry, raising 50 divisions during the war. Now, some of these were mated with armored units to form cavalry mechanized groups that proved useful in penetration, exploitations, and raids. Some of them rendered valuable service during the Stalingrad offensive in November 42. In fact, the units reached their zenith during the summer offensive of 1944. The Germans thought their flank was secure because of the vast Pripyat marshes, but the Russian horse cavalry attacked through the marshes, right into the flank of a very surprised German Army Group Center. In fact, throughout the war, over 500,000 men served as mounted troopers in the Russian cavalry. Even the United States had 2 regular and several National Guard cavalry divisions on the eve of war, committed some horse cavalry units to overseas operations, as a matter of fact. The entire 2nd Cav Division, composed primarily of black personnel, was shipped to North Africa in 43. It patrolled the frontier between French and Spanish Morocco. Everyone was afraid Franco was going to choose an inopportune time to intervene in the war. An 112th Cavalry Regiment, part of the Texas National Guard, served on horseback for a time in New Caledonia. Dismounted in May of 43, the 112th Cavalry was the last mounted U.S. formation to serve in a combat zone, officially, of course. During the Sicilian campaign, the rugged nature of the terrain prompted the commander of the 3rd Infantry Division, Major General Lucien Truscott, a no-horse soldier, to create a provisional mounted reconnaissance troop. Several other units adopted that same practice during the Italian campaign. Cavalry was also used by the Yugoslav partisans and rather extensively in China by both the Chinese and Japanese. And even the U.S. Navy, believe it or not, used mounted troops, raising a regiment from local manpower in Inner Mongolia as a security force for Navy weather stations. The Coast Guard had mounted beach patrols along the U.S. East Coast in order to prevent German submarines from landing intelligence agents and saboteurs. And despite the fact it wasn't technically a motorized formation, the U.S. Infantry Division possessed about 400,000 horsepower in its approximately 2,000 motorized vehicles. In fact, the division was actually capable of lifting all its personnel and motor vehicle for limited periods by piling troops on everything that would roll. Of course, this resulted in a disruption of unit cohesion, but it allowed for relatively rapid movement. That's one reason for the speed with which the 3rd Army drove across France in September and August of 1944. Well, you know, VD has long been recognized as a major cause of non-battle-related military non-effectiveness in wartime. Throughout the Second World War, the problem was of significant but declining importance. During World War I, the VD rate for men in the U.S. Army was quite high, about 87 cases per 1,000 men per year. That was even higher than the French. During World War II, the VD rate in the U.S. Army decreased markedly to about 56% of that of earlier war. And that was largely due to an intensive educational program to alert the troops to dangers of venereal infections. And they also had the introduction of penicillin. And not incidentally to the fact many troops campaigned in areas where there were few opportunities to contract VD, such as New Guinea. Well, I got an email wanting to know if I would talk about the Iron Cross. I mean, in every movie you see, somebody that's German is wearing an Iron Cross. And that's the highest German decoration created by the King of Prussia in 1813 during the War of Liberation from Napoleon. It drew its inspiration from France's Legion of Merit. The new decoration could be awarded to officers and men for acts of heroism in battle, to senior commanders who won victories. And as authorized, the Iron Cross awarded during the campaign of 1813 and 1814 and during the Waterloo campaign in 1815. It was not authorized for award during the Revolutionary War of 1848 and 49 or for either the Schleswig-Holstein Wars or the Seven Weeks' War with Austria, which was 1866, apparently because these were at least partially civil wars rather than genuine foreign conflicts. It was revived during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, and again in the First World War, 1914 through 1918, and the Second World War, 39 through 45, and it was given out rather liberally. As originally conceived, the Iron Cross had only 3 grades, 2nd Class, 1st Class, and Grand Cross, and remained that way until the Second World War. During that war, Hitler himself, who had earned both the 2nd and 1st Class on the Western Front during World War I, added 5 additional grades, primarily as a morale-boosting measure. So by the end of the Second World War, there were actually 8 grades of the Iron Cross. There was the Cross Cruz, Grand Cross, the Brillantin, that's the Knight's Cross with golden oak leaves, swords, and diamonds, Ritter Cruz, und... I couldn't even begin to pronounce these German words. Anyway, it translated as the Knight's Cross with golden oak leaves, swords, and diamonds. Then there's Ritter Cruz, mit... Eichenlaub, Swant, and Brillantin, Knight's Cross with oak leaves, swords, and diamonds, Ritter Cruz mit Eichenlaub and Swern, Knight's Cross with oak leaves and swords, Ritter Cruz mit Eichenlaub, Knight's Cross with oak leaves, Ritter Cruz, the Iron Cross, just the cross itself. Then there was a Eisern's Cruz, the Iron Cross First Class, and Eisernes Cruz, Iron Cross Second Class. Now, the Grand Cross has been awarded only 3 times, twice to unquestionably deserving commanders, Marshals Gebhardt von Blücher, who helped beat Napoleon at Waterloo, and Paul von Hindenburg, who led German army in striking victories on the Russian front in World War I, and once to the wholly undeserving Hermann Göring. During the Second World War, awards of the first and second class Iron Cross landed into the tens of thousands. And there were 7,377 awards of the Knight's Cross in its various versions. Now, Hitler also decorated 29 women with the Iron Cross. The most famous was Hanna Reich, his favorite woman pilot, who received both the first class and second class for her services as a test pilot. Only one other woman got a first class, the rest having to be satisfied with second class. And all the Iron Cross hadn't been awarded since the end of the Second World War. Supply was struck in West Germany some years ago, so that recipients could trade in their swastika-bedecked Nazi-era decorations for the more traditional ones. You know, one thing that we ran into in South America was problems with heat. And in tropical areas, heat is and has always been a significant danger. Among Allied troops operating in tropical areas in 42 and 43, between 15 and 20% were victims of heat prostration and similar afflictions. About 2% died. You know, combat soldiers have 2 major fears: getting killed and getting wounded. If wounded, there are additional terrors regarding how soon and how well their injuries will be cared for. Now, during World War II, of course, great strides were made in the speed and effectiveness of caring for the wounded. Best equipped in this regard are the Western Allies, who provided a number of revolutionary procedures for combat injuries. In fact, almost every unit down to platoon level had a medic. Injured troops are usually under a medic's care within 10 to 30 minutes after being wounded. And that medic would evaluate the wounds and apply first aid before sending them on up to the next level. Usually the injured soldier was at the battalion medical center within an hour of being injured. And the battalion surgeon, a regular MD, would be examining him within an hour. And if more medical attention was needed within a few hours, the wounded soldier was at a division hospital, usually 5 to 10 miles behind the front. Well, you know, one of the things that we did during the war, because as is the case between wars, the liberal establishment does its best to downplay the need for a military, so we were hopelessly outclassed. But starting from scratch, we created an airborne force during World War II. Eventually, it totaled 5 divisions, the 11th, the 13th, the 17th, the 82nd, and the 101st, and a number of independent airborne battalions. Now, only a third of the airborne troops actually came in by parachute. The rest were landed by glider. And it was always a problem how to arm these troops, as they were coming in by air and weight was at a premium. And they had practically no motorized transportation. The infantry had to carry everything. The initial organization established in 42 was similar to regular infantry, except that the paratroopers had fewer rifles. They got carbines instead, which were lighter and less range, and fewer BARs, Browning Automatic Rifle. They were 30 caliber and weighed 20 pounds, and they used a 20-round magazine. But they had more light machine guns, the M1919A4, that required the use of a 14-pound tripod, and the gun itself weighed 31 pounds. The regular infantry in 44 had 193 men, every regular infantry company, 15 BARs, two M1919A4 machine guns, 150 caliber machine gun, six submachine guns. The infantry platoon had 41 men, 37 rifles, one carbine, and three BARs. The parachute infantry company had 130 men, 12 M1919A6 machine guns. That's a 32-pound version of the 31-pound A4. Used a bipod instead of the tripod. Three 60-millimeter mortars and three bazookas. The parachute infantry platoon had 36 men, two M1919A6 machine guns, one 60-millimeter mortar, one sniper rifle, one bazooka, 22 rifles, and 14 carbines. Now, while this appeared to be heavier armament than that of the regular infantry, it just was not the case. The regular infantry had more heavy weapons available from the battalion and regimental heavy weapons units than did the paratroopers. Regular infantry regiment had six 105-millimeter howitzers, nine 57-millimeter anti-tank guns, 55 50-caliber machine guns, and a lot more 30-caliber machine guns. And the regular infantry had trucks and jeeps to haul this stuff around. Paratroopers only had a few jeeps, depending on what survived the glider landing, and not nearly as much ammunition. Well, at the end of 1944, the parachute infantry companies reorganized and reequipped. Each new company now had 176 men. It wasn't until Vietnam that they were the parachute infantry was equipped with automatic rifles, the M16, and the lighter machine guns, the M60. You know, having used both of those, a leaf could deflect the M16 rounds. But at the same time, you could send a whole lot more ammunition downrange. You know, during World War One, the biggest influence on the U.S. Army organization was the French Army. U.S. troops frequently used French organization, tactics, and equipment. And the American Army was sent to Europe in 1917 to save France, and the French were eager to assist them in any way they could. So the French provided most of the experienced instructors and a lot of equipment. And while we didn't create a clone of the French Army, the French were a major influence during World War I and for over 10 years after that. And some of this influence carried over to World War II with, well, let's say unfortunate results. The infantry platoons were organized and equipped in an almost identical fashion to those of the 1940 French Army, the ones the Germans rolled right over. So we entered the war with squads that were too large for the squad leader to control in combat, had too little firepower, and without tactics capable of dealing with the better trained, organized, and equipped Germans. A number of senior U.S. Army commanders in 1940 pointed these out, but they weren't listened to. Patton was one of the major ones. But change comes slowly in the United States Army. Of course, once we decide on a path, we move with a purpose. You know, the question was asked, what's more dangerous to being in the infantry? Well, the answer is being an American infantry replacement. We had probably the worst policy for replacing infantry casualties. And the problem wasn't seen as deficient until after Vietnam. Going into World War II, it was decided to use replacements like rounds of ammunition. When somebody in combat got killed or wounded, another man from the replacement pool would be immediately sent into that unit. And this would often be done while that unit was still in combat. Results was usually disastrous for the unit and usually fatal for the replacement. It's bad enough when done by the book. That is, the replacement comes from the United States, where they had received several months of infantry training, in addition to the basic training all soldiers received. During the heavy fighting in France and Germany after D-Day, though, many replacements weren't trained infantry, but men combed out of non-combat units and sent forward as replacements due to the heavy infantry casualties. So you might be cooking bread today and crawling through a trench tomorrow. Ironically, the brass wouldn't have thought of sending untrained replacements to tank or artillery units, or at least they expected the replacements to get some training before they were allowed to operate a tank or an artillery piece. Official policy was that since every soldier took basic training, which was oriented basically toward the infantry, any soldier could be thrown into an infantry unit and immediately begin doing an infantryman's job. Well, in actuality, the truth was just the opposite. Infantry work was far more complex and frightening than anything a tank or artilleryman had to face. Most other armies knew this, but not the leaders of the U.S. Army. When infantry replacements were sent to a unit in combat, they often came in at night, and that was so they wouldn't be spotted or shot at by nearby enemy troops. Stumbling around in the dark, they'd be led to a depleted squad, sometimes only 3 or 4 men out of the original dozen. And the veterans wanted nothing to do with the new soldiers and often put them, if there's more than one, which was usually common, off by themselves someplace where they wouldn't endanger the veterans and knew just how dangerous combat would be. So if the replacements survived the first night, and let's face it, most did not, their squad leader would try to size them up and figure out what he could do with them. You know, so few people understand what the soldier has to deal with, and they come back to places like UTEP and experience what I experienced, where the ultra left controls everything and you're just considered lower than low because you were a veteran. Among the many Army units activated after Pearl Harbor were 24 horse cavalry regiments. The 26th Cav was already fighting the Japanese in the Philippines. By the end of 42, all the units had been deactivated or converted into other arms. Survivors of the 26th were marched off to Japanese prison camps. 6 regiments of the horse cavalry converted to tank units. 4 were converted to infantry. 2 were converted to light infantry for use in the Pacific. And the 4 segregated black regiments, the 9th and 10th, the Buffalo Soldiers, and plus 2 new regiments were converted into service troops. Many of these regiments were already formed into the 1st and 2nd Cavalry Divisions. 1st Cav converted to an infantry division. The 2nd Cav was a segregated black unit that was disbanded after it landed in North Africa. Well, the remaining 8 regiments were turned into mechanized cavalry or cavalry reconnaissance squadrons. An additional 47 recon squadrons were raised. Only 42 of the 55 recon squadrons made it overseas. Armored divisions used 14 of those squadrons, while the other 28 were assigned to 13 armored cav groups, later called regiments. Cavalry squadrons were one unit type that was heavily influenced by the German example. But we didn't go far enough. We were also influenced by the less effective British reconnaissance techniques. The American Cavalry Squadron was actually a reconnaissance battalion of 743 men. Had a lot of mobility and heavy weapons, which were needed. Well, you know, mortars were an effective infantry weapon, and most nations equipped their troops with a 120-meter mortar. But this weapon was too heavy for the troops to carry with them, but is lighter than regular artillery and as effective as 105-millimeter howitzers that provided most of the firepower on the field. Oddly enough, we didn't have a 120-millimeter mortar, but a 107-millimeter model that was designed just for delivering chemical shells. Well, except for a few exceptions, chemical shells were not used during World War II. So the 107-millimeter mortar didn't have much to do except deliver smoke shells that also considered chemical weapons, even though they provided concealment for friendly troops rather than created casualties for the enemy. By 1944, it was recognized that the 107-millimeter mortars were useful as artillery, and they were finally used as such. Each U.S. Chemical Battalion had 32 mortars, and these were assigned to a corps of two or four divisions. This is quite different from the practice of other nations whose regiments were given 120-meter mortars. One benefit of the 107-millimeter mortar was that the battalions were equipped with white phosphorus shells. It created a lot of smoke, but the burning phosphorus also caused nasty casualties. The Germans responded that it was an illegal use of chemical weapons when they realized what white phosphorus could do, but this didn't result in their use of chemical weapons in retaliation. And they had the raw material shortage, so they couldn't use white phosphorus shells in retaliation. As the war went on, it became our practice to assign one mortar company, that was 8 4.2-inch mortars, to every battalion, but not only after battalions got mortars. Preference was given to units involved in attacks, and most of the shells fired were high explosive. I've dealt a good bit with mortars. In fact, during training, we were manning a mortar emplacement. And you, on the side of the pit where the mortar sits, you dig a little recessed area to put shells so they're ready, but they're not laying on the floor of the pit. And somebody went to put a shell into that little thing, and the base of the shell hit the nose of a shell already in place, and it cooked off the propellant, which looks like cheese. But it's what makes the mortar shell go. And it cooked off the propellant. The guy on either side of me got nailed. And I got a face full of it, but not a debilitating injury. You know, disease, while not the major cause of casualties, has been in pre-20th century wars, was still responsible for about half the 100 million deaths caused by World War II. And most of these deaths were caused by disease among civilians, who were usually also suffering from starvation and exposure at the same time. For soldiers, the situation was somewhat better. They were better organized and trained to survive trying conditions. There were two diseases in particular that caused a lot of death and disability. The big killer, of course, was typhus, claimed over 2 million people, mostly in Eastern Europe. Now, that disease had been a scourge there for centuries. It's generally spread by body lice. In peacetime, the lice can be kept at bay by clean clothing and regular bathing. In wartime, civilian refugees, prisoners, and troops in the field quickly get infested with lice. During World War I, German soldiers in Russia joked that it was more dangerous to shake a Russian soldier's hand than to be shot at by him. Deadly handshake was a result of the body lice problem. It was worse among the Russians than it was among the Germans. Now, the most common victims of typhus were prisoners, POWs or concentration camp inmates such as Anne Frank, who died of typhus a few weeks before the end of the war, and Soviet troops. But the Germans also had the problem. There was a major typhus outbreak in a German army in Russia during the winter of 1944-45. There were nearly 90,000 cases, and a quarter of that 90,000 died. Worse in the concentration camps, with Bergen-Belsen suffering 80,000 typhus deaths during the first 4 months of 45. And there was an outbreak of typhus among Allied troops in Egypt, North Africa, and Italy in 1942 and 43. But by applying 3 million doses of vaccine and tons of DDT, the Allies were spared major losses from the disease. The next most common disease was malaria. While typhus was most active in the winter, malaria was a summer disease in temperate climates and a year-round affliction in tropical areas. A third of the planet's population is exposed to malaria regularly, and most of these people have some immunity to this mosquito-borne disease. Troops in malaria-free areas moving into areas with endemic malaria are at great risk. Fortunately, during the war, though malaria was not a particularly lethal problem, because of extensive World War II experience with malaria, only 117 of the 58,000 dead in Vietnam were malaria victims. And those who had it were useless for combat duty. Moreover, there are many different strains of malaria. Some are lethal and resistant to treatment. And for this reason, malaria is often a major problem during World War II in the Pacific and for a while in North Africa and Sicily, where during the summer of 43, the Allies had as many men out of action because of malaria as they did from battle wounds. In Burma during 1943, it was worse. If ever men evacuated for wounds, 120 were sent out for disease, usually malaria. Intense efforts to control malaria reduced this ratio to 60 in 1944 and 40 in 1945. But it still shows how debilitating tropical diseases can be to troops from non-tropical areas. The Japanese were in even worse shape because they didn't have the enormous medical and logistical resources the Allies did. And since there's no cure for malaria, all you can do is issue medicines that suppress the disease, try to kill the mosquitoes. Quite effective, you can regularly spray the area the troops are in and evacuate the victims that are flat on their back. Now, some people do respond better to malaria than others, but still, it's a debilitating disease. The U.S., with the best preventive measures, still found that half its casualties in the Pacific were from malaria. And throughout the Pacific campaign, each day, 3 out of every 1,000 men would be out of action because of that disease. Of the dozens of other diseases that made war hell, the only other one of major proportions was endemic hepatitis. Now, this wasn't a big killer. Only 2 in 1,000 victims would die, but those who got it'd be out of action for at least 2 months and sometimes as much as a year. Nobody knows quite how this form of hepatitis spreads, but it's highly contagious. The Germans suffered much from hepatitis on the Russian front, with over 1 million cases reported. During September 1943 alone, 180,000 cases were reported. In many cases, over half the troops in the battalion would be laid down by the disease. Allies got off easy, with only 250,000 cases throughout the entire war. Well, there were quite a number of specialty units that came into existence. Ranger battalions were the U.S. Army's version of the British commando units. The British developed the commando concept early in World War II, basically amphibious raiders who went ashore in small groups, hit an enemy installation, and departed as they arrived by sea. Unfortunately, we lost sight of the British concept and allowed the Ranger units to develop into troops that were neither commandos nor regular infantry. In 1942, the U.S. Army decided to form its own commandos and called them Rangers after the backwood raiders of colonial America. During the summer of 1942, a group of U.S. volunteers, 45 men and 6 officers, went off to train with the British commandos. And these troops formed the training cadre for the 1st Ranger Battalion, which was ready for action by the end of 1942. The unit was used successfully in the U.S. invasion of North Africa. And in their first combat against French and Italian troops, they did well. That's where the troubles began. Senior commanders didn't grasp the essence of commando operation. Get them in against a target regular infantry can't handle, and then get them out again. Commanders tended to use Rangers as elite infantry. That's what the Rangers were, but this wasn't the way they were designed to be used. And certainly, they got much less out of the units at their disposal than commanders would have had they used them correctly. The Rangers also adopted a British form of organization, which was shaped by the amphibious landing craft the commandos used on their raids. Since an assault landing craft, or an LCA, could hold 35 troops, or 800 pounds of equipment, the commando and ranger platoons contained 32 men. Two platoons made up a company, which had a headquarters of four men, and six companies made up the battalion. The battalion headquarters support troops came to 108 men, giving the total strength of 27 officers and 489 men. With this form of organization, the commandos or the rangers could be sent ashore in 12 or 15 LCAs. In terms of equipment, the rangers began to differ from the commandos. The British equipped the commandos with light machine guns, submachine guns, and light mortars in the battalion headquarters and other heavy weapons as needed. British practice was to take only what was needed on a mission. Usually the commandos used only the small arms and the machine guns. The British realized the commandos weren't raiders who were being sent in to duke it out with a sustained infantry fight. But our commanders missed this point and loaded up the rangers with heavier weapons. Instead of 20-pound automatic rifles, they got 45-pound machine guns. Instead of 60-millimeter mortars, they had 81-millimeter mortars. The rangers also had bazookas, even though they kept the obsolete British anti-tank rifles. Commandos remained lean and mean, and the rangers continued to pile on the stuff to be carried. Rangers also became less mean because there were too many of them and too many casualties that couldn't be replaced with qualified troops. Well, in early 1943, two more ranger battalions were formed from volunteers in North Africa. Another two battalions were formed in the United States that year, and in 1944, a sixth was formed in the Pacific. The rangers were used to spearhead the amphibious assaults at Salerno in 43 and Anzio in January of 44. In between, three ranger battalions led assaults during the drive on Naples. In all these campaigns, there was an increasing tendency to use the rangers as very competent infantry, but this caused heavy casualties that couldn't be replaced by men of the same caliber. The quality of the ranger units declined throughout 43, and when the Anzio invasion went in, three ranger battalions tangled with German mechanized forces were virtually destroyed and subsequently disbanded. Too heavy to move and too light to fight is pretty much what summed up the situation. But the rangers and the higher commanders who used them learned from the Anzio disaster. The remaining three ranger battalions fought on throughout the war. They continued to be used as infantry, but not as much and not in situations where their lighter armament would prove to be a problem. Rangers continued to train for and occasionally pull off commando-type operations. Two battalions fought from Normandy into Germany, while the third did well in the Pacific. Now, some had blamed many of the Rangers' problems on their first commander, Lieutenant Colonel, who was promoted from captain in 2 weeks after being given a job in 42, William Darby. Darby was an artilleryman who was held responsible for loading up the Rangers with a lot of heavy weapons that slowed them down. But it wasn't just Darby. The Army didn't understand the fact the commandos were specialists to be held in reserve most of the time till they needed to pull off some desperate mission. Well, we've come to the end of another show. There'll be a lot more of this type since we are still in lockdown. Until tomorrow night at this time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.